We learnt in earlier chapters to beware of words and to watch for the pitfalls and snares they prepare for our understanding of the world. Do we know anything more of a clock than these sensations which tell us what it looks like and what it sounds like? If we pause to analyze the position and if we make our analysis correctly and deeply, we are compelled to confess that it is these sense reports alone which make up for us the actual clock that we know. Take from thing to thought away the brown, gold and black colors. The hard, round, cool and smooth feels, and the rhythmic ticking sound, how much of the clock will remain? Without these there can be no clock at all in anyone's experience. Yet without exception these are all sensations, they are all events in the mind, ideas if we wish to call them so. What we see, what we hear and what we feel are the first things that we become aware of in relation to every object. The movements within sense, nerve, brain and mind are made with such lightning-like speed that we are unable to notice the process at all. The sensations are therefore not only the first things we know about the clock but actually the last things also. It is this incredible rapidity of mental action which creates what is nothing less than an illusion of having entered into direct contact with something outside when in fact we have only entered into our own sensations. Similarly, the sight of somebody standing near is a composite result of various sensations, that is the sum of what the senses represent to our mind, but nothing more. Every separate thing that we see or experience possesses therefore an assemblage of qualities and characteristics, and each quality impresses itself individually on the senses, thus yielding a separate sensation of color, sound, taste and so on. When we cut deep down into the foundation of our knowledge of the world, we find this primal fact of sensation is its support and origin. No such knowledge is at all possible unless sight, hearing, touch and other sensations or their revived memories are first present. For each is an item of human experience. We may know many things, but the only things we know for certain are the conditions of our consciousness, that is our sensations and nothing else. It is our five senses alone that tell us about the existence of this familiar world and provide us with information about it. It is impossible to get directly at the object as an independent existence. We get only at the sensed interpretation of it, that is to say, we get at a physiological condition in ourselves. Every sensation is a private and individual matter because it is an activity originating in one's own self. It is not shared in common with others. We cannot ordinarily see directly into the mind of another. Every man can normally only observe what is passing within his own consciousness. He experiences sensations which are separate and may even be somewhat different from those of another man viewing the same object. These personal impressions of light and sound and touch which tell us of the external object are what we know at first hand, what we are immediately aware of and what we are alone sure of experiencing. The point which must be grasped, and it will need a concentrated subtlety of thought to grasp it, is that we never know the panoramic external world in itself. We see the world only through the immovable spectacles of the sense reports which we receive concerning it. We cannot bring it under direct observation. What we directly observe is our mental reaction to it, that is ourselves. Why that without ever being conscious of this certain and simple truth we live day and night in no other world than that whose form is figured for us through what is termed sensation. Unscientific and unphilosophic persons never suspect the existence of this truth. Let it not be forgotten that these statements are drawn from a long series of observations in the storehouse of modern science and that they are based on experiments made on living persons no less than dissections performed on dead ones. Let none become impatient with these pages for repeating scientific facts already known to the world. They are certainly known, but chiefly to the narrow circles of students of medicine and psychology. They are not generally known to the wider circles of layfolk. They are important to our purpose for two reasons. First, they amply confirm a crucial tenet of the hidden teaching which must be absorbed at this stage of our studies. Second, because we are appealing to facts, because we are interrogating nature in the spirit of Francis Bacon, the founder of modern science. A modern presentation of the ancient Indian teaching must be based on science because the latter is the dominant trend of modern culture and because the new scientific discoveries are beginning to support and vindicate the old Indian discoveries. But whereas science is bewildered by the facts it has gathered and does not quite know what to make of them, the hidden philosophy has a perfect grasp of those facts, for it fully understands their /a-dots and significance. Whereas science must sooner or later become philosophical or continue in perpetual bewilderment, the hidden teaching has worked out every tenet in a form which is finished to the last syllable. It knows no uncertainty, no doubts, no bewilderment. It has ascertained truth and can lead willing votaries straight to truth. If therefore we take science in our stride here, we shall not stop with science. We shall move fearlessly on and far outstrip it until we reach a verified knowledge compared with which the utterances of science are but broken stammerings before the universal mystery. Let readers be patient therefore, for we are keeping something quite new in reserve for them. Let them await the further final volume in which shall be presented for the first time in any modern form or any Western language the advanced from thing to thought and secret teachings of the oldest philosophy known to Asia, the home of this world's oldest culture, the birth of conscious experience. Any fact or event which is actually observed becomes entitled to the term experience. We ordinarily think of objects and happenings without ever realizing that we are thinking of sensations. Such realization can come only afterwards, when thoughtful analysis endeavors to understand the actual experiences. Ordinarily we are more concerned with an objectivity than the mental content immediately referring to it or than the way in which we become aware of its existence. For this is the specialized business of the psychologist. At the moment of looking at a pen we are quite unaware of the extraordinary complexity of this seemingly simple act. It might be believed that when we are conscious of all the sensations produced by the pen we perceive it. Uninstructed opinion usually believes that recognizing the existence of a pen is a perfectly simple matter of passively receiving all the sensations it yields and nothing more. Scientific investigation reveals, however, that the operation is much more complicated than that. A sensation is not further divisible by analysis, since it distinguishes a single basic quality of the object. But we are not normally aware of a single isolated sensation. That is to say, we never see the golden color of our fountain pen nib apart from its shape as a nib. Color, for instance, does not come into consciousness divorced from size and form. Nobody can examine one apart from another by the light of consciousness. Such a thing exists for us only in theoretical study and is the consequence of theoretical analysis. This is because what we are aware of is a variety of different experiences at one and the same moment, a rush of several sensations simultaneously. Thus the feeling that here is something that is hard to the touch arrives simultaneously with the feeling that here is something that is smooth-surfaced and with the visual recognitions that it is purple-colored and round-shaped. All these separate qualities, if taken in isolation, would not tell us that the object is a pen. Just as a jumbled heap of bricks produces nothing more than a sense of chaotic confusion until they are built up to make a house, so the sensations have no rational value until they are brought into related and intelligible order. We must not only form sensations, we need to be able to distinguish one thing from another, we need to be able to discriminate the form of the pen from the form of a bottle, for instance. We see a flower. We also touch it and smell its perfume. The sight, feel and smell of the flower are single sensations. The entire group of sensations must combine before they can constitute the flower for us. The simple stimulus of the colored surface of a rose may result in a sensation of redness, but only the reaction of the mind, not only to this but to all the other sensations received, such as softness, fragrance and lightness, is what finally determines our understanding that here is a rose. And what is true of the rose is true of all things experienced. To see anything is to think of it, to feel a piece of soft cloth or a log of hard wood is to think of it, and to hear any sound, whether it be the softest whisper or the roll of thunder, is likewise to think of it. All sense experience is impossible without the association of an equivalent act of thought. Everything from infinitesimal microbe to infinite space is first an object of thought, an image or an idea. Thus bare sensations remain meaningless until they are gathered up, not in series but simultaneously, and constructively put together to form a perceived thing by the mind which experiences them. A multitude of individual impressions may crowd in upon the eyes from a single pen, but not until the mental operations of associating and welding them are complete do they attain the stage of definite recognition as being the pen itself. Not until then do they divulge their meaning and their significance get appreciated. The identification of any object involves a creative process of implanting adequate meaning and giving significant association to the elementary sensations. This can arise only after all the salient sensations have been brought together in a single united experience. This is precisely what does happen, and thus sensations are converted into the thoughts of things or events as we ordinarily know them. Mind arranges, synthesizes and constructs these single and simultaneous sensations into complete thoughts or images. Each thought is contemporaneously compounded from two or more associated sensations. Each separate sensation is an element in the orderly building up of perception, so that the perceived picture of the pen is really a group of such elements brought into the full light of consciousness. We have a sensation as the first subconscious reaction to a physical stimulus from outside things, and we have a conscious thought as the first conscious reaction to the sum of sensations. The whole series appears, then, as a stimulus to the sense instrument. Such a thought is technically termed a percept, or more popularly, a perception. But as it is an actual construction within the zone of mind, it is sometimes also called a mental construct, which is sometimes shortened to a construct. From thing to thought by an outside object, then a sense impression, next a nerve transmission, fourth a brain response, fifth a subconscious mind response, sensation, and finally a fully conscious response, mental picture, idea of event, image, thought. We ordinarily know only the sixth stage in this series because it is the finished and familiar conscious experience, whereas the fifth is only the raw material for such experience. But we must not fall into the error of regarding such a perceptual thought as the mere adding together of new sensations. They certainly make its core, but it is necessarily supplemented by something more if every experience is to be adequately filled in. The mind must first interpret and then creatively form its own image of the pen, not only out of the impressions gathered by the senses but also out of those associated with the memories of earlier experiences of seeing and handling pens. It must imagine and add something to the bare message received from the senses if it is successfully to reinterpret the inverted, undersized and two-dimensional retinal image. Hence three other mental contributions inevitably enter into each act of perception and mingle with the material supplied by sensations, thus elaborating the whole into a final thought of recognition, association with past similar experience, anticipation of new experience, personal interpretation peculiar to the experiencing individual. The most important of these elements is the first. When we recognize the sensation of hardness in handling an apostrophe piece of wood, our memory automatically connects and classifies it with the store of previously experienced sensations of hardness. The remembered hardness fuses, as it were, with the new sensation of hardness. We graft familiar old impressions or unconsciously reproduce past experience on the new sensations. Thus old experience is revived and put with the new, appearing to us in the form of an actual perception. The hand may yield impressions of something hard and smooth, whilst the eye may yield impressions of something round and brown-colored, but all these sensations are merely the material to which the mind must add an element drawn from the wealth of past experience which it possesses subconsciously, and then synthetically construct the whole into the image of a table. This it does by welding all these sensations and at the same time interpreting them in the light of remembered experience. The memory of previous and associated sensations is brought in. In this way it arrives at the meaning of the thing as the round top of a table. The mind draws upon the apparently vanished past, thus rising above time's limitation, and grasps at those experiences which are most likely to help it understand the present experience. The resurrected sensations influence the making of the new image. Further proof of the contribution thrown by the past into the molding of these mental images may be found in the relative swiftness with which an adult recognizes the size, distance and shape of a thing as compared with an infant. The little creature has to learn to distinguish between one vague thing and another vague thing until both slowly begin to acquire clearer outline through familiarity and clearer meaning through experience. The infant stretches out its hand to grasp the moon, thinking it is quite close, whereas the adult sees the moon as being quite remote from his own body. But the infant's eyes registered the impressions of the moon no less faithfully and accurately than the adult's, for their construction is not in any way different. The infant's failure to perceive its proper spatial relation to the moon is not to be blamed upon the eyes, but can only be accounted for by the feebler activity of its mind in constructing an image out of its visual sensations, due to the lack of sufficient former experience to draw upon. And a child who has only just learned to read will peruse the printed page with slowness and difficulty, not infrequently mistaking one letter for another or even one word for another. The same child grown to maturity will read the same page with rapidity and accuracy. Yet the impressions and images registered by the retina are precisely similar in both cases. The eyes may be as perfect in the child as in the adult. Why then does this difference in result occur? The answer is that as the growing child reads printed books more and more frequently, its mind remembers earlier images of letters and words and increasingly contributes these recollections to the operation of reading until finally each word is fully and correctly recognized, that is, perceived for what it is. This is a plain proof of the complex and creative nature of every thought which refers to an experience. Here is a simple way of grasping how powerfully the mind contributes to present experience by drawing on the past. Listen to the same person singing two different songs quickly, one of which is quite familiar and the other quite unknown. The words of the first song will be followed with these, whereas those of the second will be followed with a little difficulty, so that it may be impossible to recognize some of them. The sounds will be heard, but they will not be distinguished as recognizable words. On the other hand, memory has added something to the sensations of sound in the first case. From thing to thought, the impression produced on the ears is of the same quality in both. And yet the hearing is confused when the song is unknown but perfect when it is familiar and recollected. It is defective in one case and accurate in the other. A mental factor is therefore present in all cases of hearing and makes its due contribution to what is consciously heard rather than what is actually impressed on the ears by sound vibrations. A strange illustration showing how the past exists as an ingredient in human perception is to be found in the case of those who have lost a leg or arm through violent accident or surgical amputation. Medical annals reveal that such persons have in several instances complained of feeling pain in the foot or fingers of a missing limb as if the latter were still connected with the body. Thus the mind can even read fictions into its experience under the powerful influence of memory. This indicates that the testimony of memory prepares the way for the entry of expectancy. Hence a further element which enters the making of an image along with the new and remembered sensations is anticipation of what the object is or ought to be. It is the final factor in shaping the thought. Not only do images of past experience enter into the train of mental activity, but so do personal emotions. Each mental construct is conditioned by our individual organization. This is well illustrated when certain optical illusions arise. We do not directly draw, therefore, entirely on new sense impressions for all our awareness. Memory of the past supplies some of it in the form of revived mental images, whilst expectant imagination supplies others, but indirectly both of these are derived from earlier sense impressions. Thus deeply ingrained mental habits, strongly seated expectations and aroused associations also take their share in this work of molding a mental picture or the thought of an event. The passage from bare sensation to full perception is not only the passage to a group of sensations simultaneously uniting in consciousness to form the experience, but is also the passage to mental interpretation and mutual adjustment of the simple sensations. The idea is a completed product when we actually recognize it as belonging to a particular class, as when red and gold colored, smooth feeling, oblong shaped, 6-inch long object is recognized as being one of the class called books. However, its formation of a percept must not be thought of as one of merely arithmetical addition. It is much more a process of instantaneous fusion. The sensations do not merely interlace, they fuse. All these operations which go to the making of experience are not performed by us so far as we are aware, nor are they directly accessible to our observation. They are performed automatically beneath the threshold of conscious mind. They are demonstrated by their effects. If we are unable to unravel these single and separate elements and expose them individually to our gaze, it is precisely because a thought is nothing other than their final and permanent fusion into a unit. During the time of manufacture, the thought forms itself automatically and beyond the control of the conscious will. We are not personally aware of this ceaseless activity of the mind in giving birth to the thoughts, images and ideas whose totality constitutes our world experience, and therefore we are not aware of the fact that the pen as it appears to us is mind-made. Thus the analysis of perception reveals that the form and size of any object which confronts us, no less than the feel and the color of it, are qualities which ultimately exist for the mind alone. This is no less true of hard and heavy things like granite rocks, for they exist for us as fused groups of sensations. Only when we become conscious of the rocks can we regard them as being there. Only felt and seen rocks can exist for us at all. We know everything through the totality of the sensations, that is the awareness it produces in us, through the colors, smells, tastes, feels and sounds which make up our physical experience and which are ultimately experiences of the mind. What we see is not the thing in itself but the thing in our mind. The thought is more intimate than the thing. How is it that the formation of a thought takes place with such unbelievable swiftness? We can only reply that originally it must have been a slow and conscious act which in the course of evolution through countless centuries was imperceptibly transformed by the individual and the race into an instantaneous and unconscious one. Familiar and frequently recurring experiences have rendered it easy for the mind to create its images practically instantaneously. The complex and complete act of seeing the object really occupies a number of successive steps, but they flash by with such unimaginable and incredible rapidity as practically to fuse into a single instantaneous operation. This rapid working is partly a result of the existing background of past sense experience into which new sensations immediately merge, and partly a result of the mind's innate power. These separate steps in the awareness of a thing do not disclose themselves to ordinary consciousness but only to scientific analysis. Hence they may appear to the uninitiated as a farrago of nonsense. They belong to a process which is entirely below the surface. They from thing to thought are subconscious to a partial or complete extent. They are described here in the way they would unfold themselves to us could we but view them individually. Perception is ordinarily such a tremendously rapid, perfectly smooth and automatic process that we do not pause to consider the great significance involved in its actual operation. Thus, sight may be viewed from three distinct standpoints. The first is the physical stimulus and is a matter of the movement of light rays from the object to the eye. The second is the physiological process and is a matter of projecting an image upon the retina. The third is the psychological construct and is a matter of first becoming aware that the object exists. Physics investigates the light, physiology investigates the eye and brain, psychology has to study the arisal of a conscious percept, whilst philosophy must not only coordinate the results of all three sciences but evaluate them and ascertain their true worth in a grander system of world explanation. Thus we may come to perceive that so long as we confine our examination to the top of the picture, so long any understanding of the way we enter into awareness of the familiar things and persons that surround us seems a simple affair, but the moment we try to view the lower part also and to gaze at the picture as a whole, then only do we begin to grasp how difficult and how complex an affair it really is. Thus too we may realize why the scientist to some extent and the philosopher to the fullest extent are not satisfied with superficial explanations of what they see and touch every day, as are common folk, but seek rather to plunge into deeper water. For in the case of the subject of this chapter, we have been led a step by step to the surprising discovery that however tangible be the everyday material things themselves, their existence is ultimately revealed to us only by our mental experience of them, that is, our knowledge of these things shuts us up within the four walls of thoughts alone. Put into plainer language, what we undoubtedly know are our ideas of what are usually said to be external objects, whereas what we erroneously believe we know are the objects themselves. The difference between the two is the difference between a cinematographic photograph of the inimitable and genial Charlie Chaplin on a white screen and the living Charlie Chaplin in the flesh. But the analogy must end. To stretch it farther is to falsify it. For whereas a photograph is after all but a copy of something, a thought is not a copy at all, it is a mental creation. It is new because it represents a new birth into consciousness, a new arisal of idea. It is an evidence of the mind's wonderful power of constructing, and not merely exploring, what it perceives. And it is also an evidence of what was hinted in the opening lines of the present chapter, that the external world is entirely relative to the mind that perceives it, that the pregnant principle of relativity rules all our observations and all our experience. Here we carry this principle to a length which Einstein has not grasped and will therefore be unwilling to follow. Those who can understand this point have received an introduction to an infallible inoculation against the crude kind of materialism which prevailed last century among the proletarian camp followers of science, and against the sanctimonious materialism which prevailed among the unintelligent upholders of religion. The fountain pen which began as a collection of sensed qualities has ended as a fragment of our mind. The last lesson of this chapter is that what we see is primarily seen as a thought, that what we touch is primarily touched as an image, and that every human experience of the physical world is essentially a mentally produced experience. Our perceptions, which seem so physical, are prominently and paramountly mental events. All the colored and odorous and felt things that we are acquainted with are ultimately experienced in the mind and nowhere else. In order to get in touch with the world of outside things, we have to think them into existence, otherwise we remain totally unaware of them. The idea which the mind thus subconsciously brings to birth represents, rightly or wrongly, as much of the thing as we know and as much as we can ever know. For we cannot go beyond our thoughts. We cannot see what they do not picture forth for us. A pen itself may be 6 inches long, but if our mind were to play the trick of showing it to us as only 1 inch long, we would continue in blissful ignorance to believe that the pen was only 1 inch long. Fortunately, such tricks are rare, although they are certainly not non-existent, as the next chapter will clearly show. And if our mind did not know that the eyes were seeing a mountain and the hands were touching it, we would not know that the mountain existed at all. We need more truth. There is no other anodyne for our troubled age. It is admittedly hard to believe that we are aware of thoughts of external things only, when all these years we have fondly believed we were aware of the things themselves. Most men are inaccessible to this tenet. It sets them down beneath a sky which is strange, cold, unfamiliar. It / frill therefore be hard to divest ourselves of the familiar conventional outlook, that is to say, the materialistic outlook. But it can be done if only we are willing to give a little time and much inquiring independent thought to the task. We must from thing to thought be pitiless and thresh out all error, all falsity and all illusion from our mentality. Our bondage to popular ignorance need not last forever. It can grow weak and insignificant as our wrong thoughts grow weak and insignificant. Instructed and concentrated thinking can work miracles, for it can turn the water of error into the costly wine of truth. Chapter 10: The Secret of Space and Time. We must now enter the most difficult stage of our inquiry into the process whereby we perceive external objects, that is to say, of our inquiry into the nature of human experience of the external world. We must relentlessly pursue this inquiry despite its difficulties, for the world is ever confronting us and silently demanding adequate understanding of its nature. It is impossible to think of the world, or of anything in the world, without thinking of it as existing in space and time. This, as has been shown, is because the mind itself plays a most important part in predetermining how we shall see the world, compelling us to see it in terms of separate and successive images. Therefore, the Indian sages said that thinking itself cannot reach and observe the world's reality or essence. The scientists who have established the theories of relativity and quantum mechanics have now found themselves in the same plight.